You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, and this is episode 424 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Can I remind you that we have two sponsors of the Columbia Calling podcast, and it's brought to you, it's sponsored by Latin News, which is a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. So sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. Thank you to Latin News for that sponsorship. And our second sponsor is, this episode's brought to you by BNB Colombia Tours, expert in custom-made travel throughout Colombia. The team at BNB Colombia Tours can provide you with fantastic private experiences, creating wonderful memories of Colombia for a lifetime. Check out the website at bnbcolombia.com. Complete the free itinerary form, and tell them that Columbia Calling sent you to receive a further 5% off their already great prices. And of course, they cover the main cities, Medellin, Bogota, Cali, Cartagena, and also things that are more out there, such as Guaviare, Meta, Casanare, down into Putumayo and so on. They can do anything. So check out BNB Colombia Tours or bnbcolombia.com and our other sponsor, latinnews.com. And this episode, 424, we'll be talking to Shefki Meji. And he's a travel writer and author of significant note, and he has a new book out called Crossed Off the Map, Travels in Bolivia. But he's written a lot about Colombia as well. So we're going to look at both countries in terms of tourism and stories. Be warned, there are plenty of anecdotes in this episode. It's a fun episode, lightening it up a little bit. We've had some quite polemic issues to talk about in the last few weeks. When is Colombia not political, I ask you? But at the same time, we're lightening this one up a little bit to talk, you know, have a good banter, I think, this time around travel and writing and Bolivia and Colombia and, well, just the curiosities that surround these two countries. So we will pass over now to Matt DeSalvo, who will be providing you with the news this week as Emily Hart is still away. And then in segment three, we come back with Shefki Meji. So thank you again for listening, and please don't go away.
I'm Matthew DeSalvo, and these are your top stories for the week of May the 16th, 2022. A Paraguayan anti-mafia prosecutor was murdered in the tourist trap of Baru last Tuesday. 45-year-old Marcelo Pecci was on honeymoon with his pregnant wife on the island near the city of Cartagena when two men arrived on a jet ski and shot him. Police have said the brazen attack was likely linked to Pecci's anti-organized crime cases in his home country. Police from Colombia and Paraguay have since teamed up with the US DEA and FBI to find the killers. Colombian police have offered a reward of 2 billion pesos, $500,000, for information leading to the capture of the killers, and said it was likely the hit was ordered by transnational criminals working across borders. The mayor of Colombia's second largest city, Medellin, was last week suspended for allegedly meddling in the country's upcoming elections. Daniel Quintero, who has been mayor since 2020, posted a video on Twitter and Instagram where, sitting in a car, he called for a change to first. This was interpreted as expressing support for the leftist Gustavo Petro, who currently leads in the polls, because it is a slogan he used in his campaign. It is illegal for public officials to participate in electoral politics in Colombia. President Iván Duque appointed one of his allies, Juan Camilo Restrepo, as an interim mayor. Both the president and the Colombian inspector general have been criticized by Medellin officials for the move. Incidentally, there are various open complaints against President Duque for intervention in electoral politics, but the leader announced that he will continue to publicly offer opinions on the candidates and policy proposals. Colombia's largest left-wing armed group, the ELN, has announced a unilateral ceasefire in the days before and after the first round of Colombia's May 29th presidential election. The group, which operates mainly in large swaths of isolated Colombia, released a statement saying the ceasefire was so people could vote peacefully. The ELN has previously held ceasefires during election time in other years. The guerrilla group, which was founded in the 60s, is heavily involved in the cocaine trade and regularly attacks government infrastructure, particularly oil pipelines. And the Colombian peso today bounced back after struggling for the past month against the US dollar. Today, the peso was the best performing Latin American currency, according to Bloomberg. The peso had been performing poorly and had fallen by 8% compared to the dollar, mainly because of falling oil prices. Today, it closed at 4,058 to one US dollar because of Colombia's good economic performance. The country's economy grew by 8.5% in Q1 this year compared with Q1 of last year, exceeding expectations. Those are your top stories for the week. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next Monday.
And we're back. This is episode 424 of the Colombia Calling podcast. My very special guest this week is Shafiq Meji. He's a renowned travel writer based in Southeast London, but he's written from all over the world. But of course, you know, brought to my attention, not only did he contract me back in 2011, so a lifetime ago, before children and before other things, before pandemic, but he's also, writes quite, I would say profoundly and extensively about Latin America, South America, Bolivia, Colombia, elsewhere. But we're going to chat about everything. Shafiq, welcome on the Colombia Calling podcast.
Thank you very much, Richard. It's a real pleasure to be talking to you.
See, we communicate on social media, but we haven't actually spoken since 2011 when we had this sort of, I guess it was kind of like an interview for what was then, I don't know if it's still around, the Nile Guide.
Yeah, it really doesn't feel that long at all. And because of, social media kind of, gives you an insight or a little snapshot into people's lives. So you feel like you've been kind of keeping up a relationship, but yeah, absolutely. Yeah, chatting like this is lovely. And as for Nile Guide, I think it burned brightly and then possibly fizzled out,
like so many travel related websites and websites as well. And of course, these things come and go, don't they? They're kind of like magazines, they come and go. There's a peak for the interest and so on. I was thinking the other day of the Matador network that must still be around because it had a huge sort of drive behind it, and the San Francisco techies that did it, but it's certainly not as big as it was back in the day.
It's still going as far as I'm aware, but yeah, I think it's kind of it's certainly not as prominent as it once was, like so many of the startups that come out of California.
That's right, isn't it? California, San Francisco, and so on. But so tell me a little bit. I mean, first of all, we'll mention it and we'll come back to it. You've got a book out. I've got it. Maybe the only copy in Colombia. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see it's called Crossed Off the Map, Travels in Bolivia. And I've read excerpts here and there because I haven't had time to sit down and read it all. But it's a really in-depth look at, I would say, I mean, a lot of South America is misunderstood or just not understood, but Bolivia is particularly one of those countries. So, I mean, you are involved with the Latin American Bureau, so this, this entity that publishes books and reports and so on, all about South America, Central America, Mexico, and so on. How is it you said, listen, we really need to do something? Like, I wouldn't say it's like a political travelogue, because everything in Bolivia is political. Everything is. So tell us a little bit about the book and how it came about.
Yeah, I mean, I first visited South America and Bolivia in 2004. I was a sports writer at the time, and I was taking an impromptu gap year, really. And at the time, I think like many people outside of Bolivia, outside of Latin America, didn't really know much about Bolivia at all. I was just looking for a convenient and cheap way to get from Brazil, where I'd been enjoying Carnival in Rio, And I wanted to get to Cuzco to start the Inca Trail to Machu Picchu. And at the time, you know, I just needed to travel overland through Bolivia. Bolivia was just an obstacle for me to get from A to B. But you know, I was so glad I made the journey, because as soon as I entered Bolivia and started to travel around it, realize it's such a place of extremes, with the highest cities on earth, the biggest salt flat, the highest, largest high altitude lake, the most biodiverse national park, the most dangerous road, so on and so on. And as as I traveled through it, it really made an impact. It kind of grabbed hold of me, and never let go. And then, that journey around South America really prompted me to change careers. Came back to London and I became a travel writer eventually, and started writing guidebooks for Rough Guides. And eventually that led on to work on the Rough Guide to Bolivia around a decade ago. And that really allowed me to explore Bolivia in far greater depth than I would have possibly would have been able to otherwise. And I was also very lucky in that it was a particularly dramatic and turbulent and, impactful time in Bolivian history as well. So I was fortunate from those terms. And really, the idea for the book came from those research trips. As I learned more about the fascinating history of Bolivia, these fragments of history that been forgotten beyond its borders. Thought that's a great story to tell. And then increasingly it felt like the future had already arrived in Bolivia, that this was a country that is dealing with the consequences of the climate crisis, has been dealing with the consequences of the climate crisis for, many years now, is dealing with issues like populism and the war on drugs and migration and all of these kind of things that I think will shape all of our lives all around the world. In the years and decades to come, it just seemed like a fascinating story to tell, to kind of both look back at a fascinating history, to look at how Bolivia is also coping with these contemporary challenges, and to bring them together in a book. And I couldn't really believe that someone hadn't done it beforehand. These are so brilliant stories. But I think, like lots of things in Latin America, there's not a great deal of coverage in the English language media, in the international media, that there's not enough books and articles and podcasts and all of these kind of things. This is my small attempt to try and put that right for Bolivia at least.
If we're looking at, I guess you said 2004, did you travel through the Chaco then, through Paraguay overland, or did you go straight through from Brazil through Acre, I think it is, into Bolivia?
Yeah, no. So I was in the I traveled through the Pantanal, which obviously most people associate with Brazil, the world's largest tropical wetlands, but Bolivia also has a huge chunk of it too. And so I was traveling through the Bolivian side of it and the Brazilian side of it, crossed the border into Bolivia, and then took what are known as the death trains that run from the Brazilian border all the way to the city of Santa Cruz, and that was an incredible. You're traveling through the wetlands, you see incredible wildlife from the train. It's got a very evocative history, the train, of course. And then arriving in Santa Cruz was really an eye-opening experience. I'd never been anywhere quite like it before. There were Mennonites that I met. There were the Japanese Bolivian communities there. There were sloths in the trees of the central plaza. There were these huge blacked out 4x4s, these narco cruisers, as they were called. There was the first of many, many hundreds and hundreds of political protests that I've seen and experienced in Bolivia, with banging pots and pans. And it was kind of an incredibly vivid experience. It kind of grabbed me and shook me. And I think from that moment I was hooked. And absolutely, as I traveled more through the country on that trip, and then subsequently for work for the Rough Guides, that feeling just intensified, really.
So it's kind of, there's a compendium of past stories, but brought up to date, isn't it? It's like you're taking in a lot of reflections, which makes it very nice. I also think, for me, you know, I got to Bolivia. How did I get there? I can't remember. Down through Peru the first time. So it was in the early 2000s, before 2004, I think. I can't remember. It's been so long. And then I came through and there were protests all the time. I mean, all the time. But I had seen protests in Peru prior to the elections, and I'd seen protests in Guatemala, where I'd lived previously, and elsewhere. But Bolivia was the most vivid. And I remember being in La Paz, and of course the main road down the middle, which sort of descends down the bowl, and there's a bridge towards the bottom, and the miners were striking. And this is prior to 2004. I'm absolutely sure it's like 2001, and they were striking over their, you know, their conditions that they lived in and the poor pay and so on. And they hung up nooses on the bridge and said they were going to hang themselves because death was better than what they were living. And then the riot police came out, and they were, so the miners started throwing their sticks of dynamite at them. And I was sitting in a kebab shop, as you do, on this road, just behind a glass. And it never occurred to me that I might be in trouble. I was just watching it as if it was on TV, because it was so far, it was so far displaced from anything I'd ever seen before. And so this, you know, this all sort of wound down after dynamite and so on else. And then the next day, there was a women's demonstration in front of that building, which I guess it's the Bolivian Institute of Human Rights, right there as well. Like, nice big building, kind of, I think it was like a pink color or something. Anyway, the women, the indigenous women, so the Aymara and the Quechua women, were all protesting. And they were protesting in their bras, because of the rights, and they said if the government and whoever was involved didn't come out to negotiate or talk to them, they would take their bras off. And I think it was Banza who was in control, the President Banza, after, you know, obviously not during the dictatorship, but he came back, I guess it was, what, 15, 20 years later. Anyway, that government caved. They said, we are not taking your bras off. We will talk to you. I mean, and I just remember going, I don't really know what I'm doing, but I love it. And then after a while, traveled around the country all over, and then decided I'm going to go to Paraguay. And through the Chaco. And I was really, after getting in Santa Cruz and finding a Mexican restaurant, and I looked at it and went, well, there's a lot of people in there. It must be good. And I mistakenly thought there were tourists as well, but they were all the Mennonites dressed in their, you know, their dungarees and straw hats. And they were watching Benny Hill on the big screen. I mean, it was just one of those bizarre, and this was Bolivia in a nutshell. Then I caught the bus from Santa Cruz. And it must have been moving drugs, because we got stopped so many times and there was cash around. And then we got delayed somewhere in the middle of nowhere. And there were also young ladies who were going off kind of illegally to work as maids in Uruguay. And I mean, everything on my bus, it was the cheapest bus. That's what happened. You know? And I mean, and then as we got into Paraguay, just some Paraguayan kid got up in, I don't know, some rural part of Canada, Paraguay. He got onto the bus, and he can't have been older than like 10 or 12. He just decided, I'm going to Asuncion. So he got on because he had the money. And then a little bit further down, we got stopped and the kid got taken off. And he's just like, what's going on here? And then there was another sort of like checkpoint. I guess everyone's getting their cut of each like commission for this, the movement of this bus. And we all had to go in. And of course, I am a foreigner amongst Peruvians and Bolivians and everyone else. And, you know, they sort of just waved me through. But the Peruvian young ladies were, you know, pretty girls. And I remember that they were from Chiclayo, northern Peru. And I remember them well. They were going to Uruguay. That was the thing. And the border policeman, or the guy who was checking, the migration guy in Paraguay, said, I'm not going to stamp your passports to the Peruvian girls. And they were like, what? No. We need more pretty girls in Paraguay. So you just stay here. Like that is, of course, these girls started crying and stuff. And the guys, I guess, you know, he sort of laughed it off as if it was a joke. But at no moment at the beginning was it a joke. You know, no moment. Mm. And I just think this whole, again, it was very much for me, I guess, as an impressionable 22, 23-year-old or whatever I was at the time, it was really seeing a different world that, you know, I traveled a lot, but this was right up and close. And I think Bolivia, you know, represents that. And if we get onto another subject there, you did mention, well, it's definitely in the book, the lithium, and we just said the capitalism side of things that Bolivia is facing. So no more anecdotes from me. I just went there. But the capitalism side, because this is where, you know, Evo Morales comes in, and this, you know, the two sides, of course, Santa Cruz and La Paz El Alto, Sucre to another side, really. But this friction in the country, isn't it? It's just, I mean, what's going on now today in 2022 regarding all this? Because I know that we had Jeanine Añez present for a bit. And now, where are we now? Sorry, bring us up to speed.
It's difficult to say from day to day and hour to hour with any confidence. During my time traveling, you know, in Bolivia, I kind of saw, you know, experienced that, you know, the Evo Morales years. I mean, he came to power not long after I first visited, and all the way through the, you know, the last 10, 15 years of me traveling, he was in power until 2019. And you really saw huge change in the country. Huge numbers of people, millions and millions of people brought out of poverty. There's a lot of development. There's a real flourishing of kind of indigenous pride and identity, and a throwing off of, you know, long held repression. But, you know, he stayed in power an awful long time, like a lot of people tend to do, you know, the political figures, and stayed in power too long. I mean, one of the anecdotes that I recount in the book is talking to a supporter of Morales in El Alto, which is one of the hotbeds of his support. Talking to him in 2016, just before a referendum that would have allowed Morales to stay in power even longer. And he said, his supporters said, I supported him all the way through. He's been the best, you know, the best leader of our country we've ever had. But I won't be voting for him in this referendum. We don't want him to stay in too long. He said, we don't want a king in Bolivia, which I thought was kind of quite a nice way of summing it up. And I think, unfortunately, Morales, although he certainly had a positive impact, it's, you know, he also had a negative impact in many, many aspects of life as well. And I think it's hard to argue that he didn't stay in power too long. Anyway, scroll forward to 2019, which because of the pandemic seems like another world, and certainly in Bolivian politics as well. And it looked like there was another general election, even though there was a lot of unhappiness with him running again. It did look like he was going to be re-elected, but then there were, you know, after the vote, there were allegations of electoral fraud, you know, accusations one way or another, and eventually, you know, protests on the streets, and, you know, eventually he was asked, I use inverted commas around asked. He was asked to leave for the good of the country by military figures, and then, you know, he left, and in the power vacuum, it was taken over by in some ways the polar opposite of him, you know, an extremely right wing, staunch Christian figure in Añez. And there was huge amounts of, you know, human rights abuses and repression and so on. And obviously they had to deal with the pandemic as well, which obviously broke out a few months later. And, Bolivia, like many parts of the world, was very badly affected by that. You know, trying to bring it up to date in a concise way, which is always a bit of a challenge, now the MAS party, the party of Morales, is back in power. They were overwhelmingly, democratically elected. And Morales himself, who was in exile in Mexico first and then in Argentina, is now back in the country, although not in the presidential palace. So and really they're going through something of a reckoning about what happened during the election and the human rights abuses that happened during the period after it, as well as, you know, trying to cope with the pandemic and cope with the climate crisis and cope with all these other issues that are, you know, major issues for Bolivia particularly. So it's it is always, whenever you visit, it is always an interesting time politically in Bolivia.
Well, watch this segue, how I move it over to Colombia now. I think what you talk about and what you've been mentioning and what you write about, there's so much of it can be transposed quite directly to other countries in Latin America. There is, you know, I don't know if it's because they're neighbors and they see from one another and so on, but, you know, this issue of staying in power too long, the issue of climate change, which is, it should be at the forefront of every political, do we still say manifesto, or every political campaign, because it truly affects the people and, of course, the most at risk. And when you look at like El Alto, or you look at other parts of Bolivia, it's the big mountain, Illimani, I want to say something like that.
Illimani, but yes, that overlooks, a beautiful mountain that overlooks La Paz and El Alto.
And all of these things that are definitely affected. I mean, here in Colombia, everywhere. I mean, where I am in Bogota, and the floods, or then the droughts, and when elsewhere around the country, it's everything. Landslides all the time. But the politics, and you had Evo Morales, who, had he not wished to hold on to power, would have probably gone down as one of the most positive presidential periods in South American history, I would say. You know, I'm not saying that everything he did was right and everything, but when you look at the bar was pretty low as well. Banza, it was a Quiroga, I want to say, and then Mesa, and who's the El Gringo? I can't remember his name. They called someone Gringo.
There was Goni, who you might be thinking of, very wealthy and was deposed was toppled just before Morales came to power. But yeah, it's a motley bunch, and particularly, certainly initially, Morales was a hugely influential figure. I mean, you know, the most influential figure in Bolivian history over the last 100 years, and I'd say certainly one of the most influential figures in South American history over the last 100 years or so. But yeah, you know, it's a common problem. It's not a problem limited to South America, far from it, of people, not political figures, not leaving at the right moment, or not knowing when to leave at the right moment, or not being nudged out of the way at the last, you know, but before they, you know, they ruin their before they ruin their record. And I think I think unfortunately that's probably happened with Morales.
It happens all too much. And now, is he in a position where he is let's put this carefully, advising the current government? Is it a puppet government? I mean, this is the question.
No. From my perspective, I think it's, you know, it's a capable and different leadership to Morales, and I think Morales would obviously like to, you know, have influence with him. But I think the leadership is also, you know, as far as I'm aware, kind of tried to put a bit of distance between themselves and Morales, because there was opposition to Morales pre-2019 from both the right and the left. You know, it's like everything in life, and particularly in Bolivia, it's a very nuanced situation. There were lots of different criticisms of him, and it wasn't just a kind of, you know, reactionary far right, you know, response to him, although that was certainly present as well. So I think probably wisely the new leadership is trying to, you know, strike its own course. It's you know, to show that the party is, you know, is bigger than Morales. But, you know, Morales is a huge figure. He remains hugely popular within, you know, certain parts of the population, and he's a strong character to put it mildly. So is this the end of his story? I would strongly suspect not.
Yeah, there'll be some influence in decades to come from this. Of course there will. And then, of course, after his time, it will still be looking back. It's amazing, really. And there was one mention in the book, and I didn't follow up, though, and you did talk, and I'm again going off on a digression here, but you mentioned the San Pedro prison. Did you get in the end?
No, so this is an interesting story, and I think it kind of it speaks to something that as a travel writer one of the issues that you kind of come across a lot. So on my first visit as a backpacker, when I was a sports reporter before changing my career, becoming a travel writer, I was I'd read the books about Marching Powder, the very famous book about life in San Pedro prison in La Paz. And when I was there, I met other travelers, other backpackers that had gone into the prison and had a tour and got up to all kinds of activity. And, I was much younger man at the time, I kind of, less perhaps aware of what are the negative consequences of these kind of things. So I was quite keen to go in. But, however, there'd been some security issues while I was in La Paz, and they'd tightened everything up, and just for that, for those few weeks, they weren't you weren't able to get in. So I never actually got in, and in retrospect, I'm really glad that I didn't, because it's a voyeuristic time kind of tourism, really, and it's the tours have been linked with a lot of problems in the prison. Prisoners' families are often in the prison with them. There's serious problems of violence and abuse, and some of these have been linked with tours and backpackers going in naively or for a great story to tell. And there's definitely periods of my life when I was younger that I wouldn't have thought I would have done the same. So yeah, so I never went in, and I'm glad I didn't. But I do write about this a little bit in the book, because it's a fascinating, it's another window into a certain aspect of Bolivian life, where the prisoners are required to buy, in inverted commas, or rent their own cells. If you can't afford to do that, you're essentially sleeping outside, and you're suffering very badly. If, however, you have lots of money, if you're if you've been made a lot of money through political corruption or through drug trafficking or something else, your cell can resemble a five-star hotel room. So it's a society in microcosm inside the prison. And interestingly, it's this fascination with life in Bolivia's prisons or South American prisons isn't a new phenomenon at all. One of the texts that I used to research the book was written by an American in the 1910s, and he visited the prisons in La Paz to get an insight, and no doubt to indulge in a bit of voyeuristic tourism. If people are thinking of visiting, I would strongly advise not to do so for various reasons.
Well, I didn't get in either. I would have at that age, I would have probably killed to have got in for the stories, to one-upmanship as a backpacker. However, as a sort of social projects guide or so on, when I was in Quito with a group of English gap year students, we used to make trips into the Quito women's prison and the men's prison. It was incredibly voyeuristic, but part of it was within their first week of arriving, and I was with them for 3 months, and it was to stop them from wanting to get involved in anything illicit. And it was a very good way, but it always terrified me. And the third time I was going to go in, of course, the police only control the door to get in and to get out. And they said, well, you had to get a stamp on the underside of your forearm, and a stamp that said you could come out. So almost like a migration stamp for your passport. And they said, well, we can stamp you in, but we can't stamp you out. And I'm like, what is it? Well, no, there's a riot going on. So you can go in, but we can't guarantee you can get out. And I was like, yeah, we're just not going in. But so we would always visit the English people and we'd sit in their cell and they would talk to us. And it was always just like, my God. But I think at the end of it, we ended up in one of the sort of top end wings, as you would say. And there were hanging baskets of flowers, bougainvillea from the thing. And there was a burger bar where they were flipping burgers in the corner. And everyone had their own TV. A lot were Colombians because they'd been involved in, you know, narcotics. And I recall the day it was Manchester United was playing Exeter City in the FA Cup. Now, I went to Exeter University way back from my undergrad. And I remember, so I had a soft spot for Exeter City. I stuck my head into one of the cells. I said, oh, look, my team's playing. He was Colombian. He smiled at me. Yeah, Manchester's a great team. I went, no, the other one. He went, what, the shit one? So there you go. That's my story. My one nutmanship. But I understand exactly what you're saying. And as an older individual now, I'm completely aware, but I would have been totally unaware. But it was a different time. It was a different practice, and it was for a different motive as well. But I think we've been talking for a long time. But I mean, Bolivia, of course, is very topical for you because of the book. How has the reception been?
Oh, it's been really good so far. Yeah. I mean, it came out on the 15th of March, and it's been a real whirlwind of interviews and talks and articles and so on. But it's been I've had a lovely response from readers, and that's really been a gratifying kind of experience. It seems to have chimed with quite a lot of people. Yeah. And for me, it's I'm hugely passionate, an evangelist for visiting Bolivia, for championing Bolivia. So so it's been nice to see the book out and really take it to a new audience, really, and to kind of publicize Bolivia a bit to people that may not have heard about it before. And actually, at least one reader has said that they're booking some flights, having read the book, to visit, which is that's the nicest possible compliment you can get when you write those kind of books. And also because it's as much as I love Bolivia and there's a lot of positive things about it, and I talk about the incredible landscapes, the wonderful national parks, the Salar de Uyuni and Titicaca and all of these places, it doesn't shy away from the more difficult or the darker aspects of the country. So I'm delighted. I've at least prompted one person to travel out to explore Bolivia for themselves.
Well, this is it. Again, if you're watching on YouTube, crossed off the map, travels in Bolivia. There it is. It's really, what I have read has been great. And as you say, I don't think you should shy away from the more difficult points. I mean, again, it's all complex from Colombia all the way down, or Colombia all the way up. It's all complex. And this is one of my issues I have, and I've talked about it before, is this country branding campaigns that I suppose everywhere has them. I think Ecuador always focuses on the Galapagos, which again is a tiny, tiny part of what Ecuador has to offer. Brazil usually then focuses on Carnaval. Again, that spreads across the country, but people have the image of Rio and the Samba Drome, and Panama is the canal, and there's all these different things. Guatemala's was always quite good for me because it was like the heart of the Maya world, which it's not wrong because it does extend across the country. But for Colombia, I don't know what Bolivia, if they have a country sort of branding, but Colombia for me is one of those things, is we can't turn our back on the negatives. It's not about embracing it, but it's about coming to terms with it. And I think that's what you do in the book as well, is that you are bringing it out. You've got talks about the Chaco War between Bolivia and Paraguay, where and Paraguay's nonsensical attacks on these things and so on. It is important, and it is very much in the region. But because I would say, after sort of colonial period, I'm not going to go back before that, this is, from colonial period to now, is a very contemporary culture, and of course a search for identity. And you address that in the book, I mean, because that is what it is. And this is something I've been trying to work on in my own projects in Colombia is, what is an identity of a country like Colombia or like Bolivia? Bolivia, I would say, has got further, having elected Morales. There is an acceptance of the original, what would you call it, aboriginal, so the original people of the land. Of course, the population is much, much larger. Let's say the indigenous original people, the Quechua, Aymara, mm-hmm. and so on. Colombia, it's a, you know, a minority. Of course, there's to the whites and the mestizos and so on. But it's this question that is constantly there about these identities. And I wonder, and I'm picking your brains because I'm thinking about some of the articles that you did recently about Colombia. You've done Providencia for the BBC, so the paradise island just off Nicaragua, basically. So the sister island to San Andres, which is not my most favorite place, but Providencia is amongst them. I think I've been two or three times. Tom Feiling did a book, you know, on that as well. He was on the podcast maybe 200 episodes ago or so. You wrote a piece on the Llanos. So, you know, so if you go south of Bogota to Meta, the Llanos, and then over or to Casanare for Wanderlust, and you were with friends of mine who have operators there, Julia Andres, Wild Llanos, which is just amazing. And you wrote another piece, like Discover the Real Colombia, and you've written a piece about Chicha for Tonic Mag. These are all incredibly different articles. You know, you couldn't take one thing out of them and say, this is Colombia. I mean, how do you feel about this?
I mean, to be honest, this kind of sums up my writing career in that I'm drawn to these kind of stories. I mean, I think, you know, I turn your question on its head in really that I think, you know, all of us have multiple identities and countries particularly. And, you know, as you say, in tourism branding campaigns, you know, it often reduces it down to a single image or a single aspect of, you know, Bolivia, for example, is often seen as an Andean country, and people think of it as mountains, and that's how it's sold. A third of it is in the Amazon basin, you know, and the rest of it is wetlands, and so yeah, I'm always interested in kind of looking beyond the stereotypes and trying to explore, you know, identities or aspects of the of countries or in fact geographical areas that are often overlooked, and that's what I really try to do. When I was in Colombia, because, you know, Colombia is incredibly diverse, of course, but, you know, often from a touristic point of view, it's the Andes and the Caribbean that are sold, and rightly so. There's fantastic places to visit in both, but a lot of these stories have been told, you know, repeatedly, and I'm always interested to look at stories that haven't been told and that are underappreciated, and to, you know, see what light they shine on the country, and also maybe, you know, encourage people to explore and to read further. And so, you know, I initially came out to research, you know, a story in the Llanos, and an absolutely incredible region, and you know, and to spend some time with the Llaneros, with the cowboys, to see how the traditional lifestyles are continuing, to see how that intersects with issues like conservation, to explore some some really wonderful and positive sustainable tourism operations around these private reserves, which are set around the atolls, these massive cattle ranches, and also, you know, on the same trip, almost as far away from the Llanos as you could get, to Providencia, which is, you know, while I was there, someone described it as the least Colombian part of Colombia. I think slightly tongue in cheek, but it's obviously, you know, it doesn't fit, you know, in many ways in cultural terms with what outsiders might perceive of Colombia. Guess even what many Colombians would perceive as themselves. But I think, you know, and Providencia, quite apart from being, you know, hands down one of the most beautiful places to visit, not just in Colombia, in Latin America and the Caribbean. It's wonderful for diving. It's has beautiful beaches. But yeah, the history of it and the identity of the people. They have a different language. Typical religious beliefs are often different. It's got a very distinctive history of pirates and Puritans and you know, slave owners from Jamaica and indigenous settlers from Central America, and it's a real kind of you know I won't use the melting pot, you know, cliche, but it's a real mix of different cultures, and it's got a very, you know, a fascinating history, and all of that is kind of, you know, that you can explore in you know, surrounded by some of the, you know, the most beautiful waters. And
if I could jump in, is the history really appeals to me about Providencia. I mean, the history of this, and I obviously, you know, we're all kind of taken by the somewhat romantic, obviously very tragic history, the piracy and so on. And of course, Henry Morgan launching his sacking of Panama from Providencia. And if there's any pirate experts out there, I've been doing my research, and one of the pirates who was sort of launching one wing, I guess, of this attack was called Lawrence Prince. Now, Lawrence Prince is actually Dutch. So it's Lawrence Prince, P-R-I-N-S. Now, late, just before going on with Henry Morgan, he had sailed up the Magdalena to try and sack Mompos. And I haven't found any more than just that mention. And that's one of my big investigation. So please, anyone out there, and I was wondering, in your research on Providencia, did you find anything?
I mean, I would love to just pull out of my back pocket a yellow document that, you know, provides new insight into this story. Sadly not. Other than that, there was, you know, there was a big Dutch pirate presence on the island, you know, and some of the initial settlers. It was thought to be initially uninhabited before the pirates arrived, and then they were replaced by the Puritans, who were then replaced by the Spanish, who were then replaced by more pirates. But there was a strong Dutch presence, but obviously both in the pirates and through the Puritan settlers from the UK. So, you know, I'm sure there are people out there better qualified than me that will be able to shed some light, because it's a fascinating story. And I think there's so many of those kinds of stories of kind of the European presence in, you know, during the early colonial periods in that part of the Caribbean. And there's some incredible stories, you know, still to unearth.
It's true. We've been going over these things, and I think the last thing we need to talk about is because the magazine is so print and we can't get it online, Tonic Magazine, you wrote about chicha. So the traditional, I would say, South American fermented drink. And we've tried it in all sorts of countries, but you wrote about the Colombian chicha. And I know now that it's becoming, there's quite a high-end chicha coming out that's being exported internationally. Tell us a bit about the chicha and the story there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think like lots of people, so much of my travel is primarily through my stomach. You know, it's kind of led by that. And but you know, I think also food and drink is also a great route into a country. To writing about it kind of gives people a bit of an insight and throws them into it. So yeah. So while I was you know, researching the Providencia story and the Llanos story, I spent some time in Bogota looking into the history of chicha for Tonic Magazine, which was launched during the pandemic. An excellent magazine, actually. And it's you know, I've had chicha in various parts of the world, including in Bolivia, in Cochabamba, supposedly the best chicha that can be had in Bolivia. But the story in Colombia, I thought, really shed light on Colombia's history, and it was almost a prism to explore Colombia's history, or certainly a part of Colombia's history. And so I kind of delved into the ancient indigenous origins of it, and that it was a sacred drink and what it was used for, and that when the conquistadors arrived initially, they were very interested in it, but then there was a lot of pushback, because you know, traditionally the chicha makers were indigenous women, often single women, who had a lot of status and social power and economic power within their societies, which didn't really chime with the beliefs of the Spanish. And then over the centuries since chicha became, you know, really a drink of the working class, but also faced prohibition and a lot of stigmatization, including by the governments and including by leading brewers who, you know, knocked up these incredible pieces of propaganda, really, which are, you know, promoting the values of drinking a healthy pint of you know, European beer and associating it with modernity and health and modernity and Europeans specifically, whilst, you know, casting light on chicha as if it was somehow leads to criminality and sexual proclivity and, you know, corruption and all of these kind of things. And that this is something in the past and that beer, modern brewed beer is the future. And then, in the Bogotazo, so, hugely, you know, important, event in Colombian history, chicha is involved in that too. The authorities, you know, even blamed a lot of the violence and the unrest on chicha and used it as an excuse essentially to ban it. And it was kind of to a certain extent, it was banned until I think it was 1991 or so. And although it remained popular in indigenous communities, the chicherias, the bars in which you would drink chicha, which I think at the turn of the 20th century there were around 800 in Bogota alone. So these were quite, they were significant places, and they were places where people would meet and talk, maybe talk about politics and identity and why they were unhappy with the government and why they were not receiving enough wages for their jobs and all of these kind of things. So, the nice part of the story is that it's having something of a renaissance now because fermented products all around the world, kimchi and kombucha and all of these kind of things have had a real renaissance in recent years. You know, it's viewed as very healthy and kind of, you know, lots of beneficial aspects of them. And, you know, to a certain extent, something's happening with chicha as well. And I met some chefs who are doing really wonderful things with it, using it in their high-end creative cooking, producing beautiful vinegars with it, producing their own artisan versions to drink. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you go to Candelaria, you walk and see where the students are, you can go and get chicha today, and it's still thriving there. So it was a really interesting issue to explore. A drink that's got ancient origins, but is still very relevant today as well.
That's that the point about the sort of banning, the prohibition, and of course the image, the lie being sold of the primitive nature, the past. We're looking to the future. I had one of my Patreon supporters ask me a question and asked me to find, you know, a chef to talk about Colombian food, believed amongst many, myself not included, because there are dishes here that are very tasty and very sort of varied in their flavors. But, you know, standard food is your, let's fill and stick to your ribs because you're going out to work in the fields. You know, Colombia was, until recently, a very rural country, but now, you know, the majority of the population has moved into urban areas and so on. But she said that she had heard or read many years ago or many months ago that the indigenous foods and traditional indigenous foods, so such as, and chicha would fall under that category, and that being prohibited by the Spanish. So therefore, that has resulted in the more bland food in Colombia today. I found it a very interesting concept. It's not something I had thought about. There could be some truth to it, I suppose. If you're trying to suppress the previous culture, the existing culture, and then, you know, bring in and introduce other things, whatever they may be, perhaps that is a way of altering a culinary culture. I don't know, but you've just brought it up for me. But I thought it was a very interesting point.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, if you look around the world, so often food and drink is tied in with identity, with national identity or regional identity, and so on. And, you know, during the colonial period, you know, not just in Colombia but across the world, it was to try and create a new identity, to stamp on, you know, a new identity, and that meant often that traditional foodstuffs and drinks, as well as other aspects of culture, had to be repressed or pushed aside or so on. And that was certainly the case with Chicha in Colombia, you know, as I said, the conquistadors were initially fascinated with it. They'd had huge long journeys, and it was plentiful alcohol as well. So, but it didn't take long, and it often, you know, with the authorities to look down on it and try and, you know, repress it or stifle it. Often involving the church. I think that, you know, the church would try and encourage its congregation not to frequent these chicherias where you know, who knows what might have been discussed amongst who knows, you know, who knows who. So I think, you know, chicha is just one of those stories, but I think you could probably travel across Latin America and indeed further afield and find foods and drinks and so on that tell similar kinds of stories. And often, you know, we don't know so much about them now. I mean, I was definitely struck with writing the piece about chicha in that I got a really good response from Colombians as well about it, particularly, you know, Colombians who hadn't, you know, obviously knew about it, but didn't perhaps kind of, you know, hadn't tried it or wouldn't, you know, certainly hadn't tried it since their student days. And so it was it was interesting to hear that. And obviously because also there's a very different attitude to it there compared to say Bolivia. If you go to Cochabamba, you know, one of the major cities, there's, you know, chicharia everywhere, and it's, you know, there isn't the stigma, you know, that would have been applied to it, you know, however many hundreds of kilometers, thousands of kilometers further north. I think, you know, it's remarkably resilient. It's a resilient drink. It's been drunk for thousands of years, you know, it's survived this far, which I think is admirable.
Do you think the English version would be like mead?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably types of beer, you know, various types of beer, you know, in some ways, chicha is a type of beer, and the types of beers have been, you know, brewed, you know, for millennia in cases, and I'm sure that there'll be regional versions of that in the UK. I mean, certainly if you're in, you know, I don't know, say like place like Nottingham with a, you know, very strong brewing tradition, you know, there'll be a lot of identification with the certain, you know, with the beers that they produce. But you know, I mean, it's there's a fantastic story, no doubt, to be written about the British equivalent of chicha. Maybe after we've finished this podcast, that might be something I'll look into for my next piece.
And then come and research it, and I'll invite you to a chicha. Well, no, actually, you could show me. You probably know, you know, the places better than I do. But I think that's a very good part to end on. And I'd like to say thank you so much for your time. We've been talking to Shafiq Meji, you know, very renowned travel writer, book out now. Get it if you're in the slightest bit interested in Latin American politics. This goes far into it. It's called Crossed Off the Map, Travels in Bolivia. You can find it on his website. You can find it on Latin American Bureau's website. Everywhere else, you'll find it. And, of course, the reception has been very good because I guess it's the first of its kind. So congratulations on that. And thank you for coming on this episode 424 of the Columbia Calling podcast.
Thank you very much, Richard. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. The time's flown by.
It has. So thank you again. And I hope that when we get more, you know, there's more writing down the line and more books you've written, we'll have you back on to reflect as well, because, you know, we reflected on San Pedro and not having gone in and what we would have been like at age 18 or 20. Now I'm in my mid 40s and I think, you know, two kids down and things are quite different. So listen, have a good rest of the week and weekend, and thank you for your time, and I'm sure we'll be talking again in the near future.
Thanks very much, Richard. Look forward to chatting to you again soon.
It's a pleasure. This has been episode 424 of the Columbia Calling podcast.
And a final word from our sponsors on this episode 424 of the Columbia Calling podcast. The Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. That's Latin.
latinnews.com for all your news from Latin America and the Caribbean. Highly recommended. And our other sponsor this week is BNB Colombia Tours, experts in custom-made travel throughout Colombia. The team at BNB Colombia Tours can provide you with fantastic private experiences, creating wonderful memories of Colombia for a lifetime. Check out the website at bnbcolombia.com. Complete the free itinerary form and tell them that you heard this advertisement on Colombia Calling. If you heard it here and you say so, you get a further 5% of their already great prices. Now that is a deal. So if you're thinking about going to Bogota, Cartagena, Medellin, Coffee Zone, Guaviare, the Llanos for some horse riding and viewing the animals out there, well, check out BNB Colombia Tours. Highly recommended. This has been episode 424 of the Colombia Calling podcast. Thank you again to our very special guest, Chef Kimeji. Do check out his book that is Crossed Off the Map, Travels in Bolivia. Highly recommended as well. And thank you again to Matt DiSalvo for the news this week. This has been Richard McColl for Colombia Calling, signing off. We'll be back next week with episode 425. A huge virtual hug to all of our sponsors on Patreon. And of course, please keep on sharing the word, sharing us out there on social media, and supporting us by listening week in, week out. Farewell.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.